From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor Don Cheadle. He played an ex-con with a short fuse and devil in a blue dress, and a porn star with a taste for country music and hi-fis and boogie nights. Now he's starring in Hotel Rwanda as a hotel manager who saves more than 1,000 Rwandans from genocide. Also, we hear from General Romeo Dallaire. He commanded the UN peacekeeping troops in Rwanda during the 1994 genocide. Dallaire was denied authority to intervene militarily. His memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, is now out in paperback. And critic-at-large John Powers reviews Mikey and Nikki, the 1976 film written and directed by Elaine May. It's just been released on DVD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest actor Don Cheadle is currently starring in the film Hotel Rwanda, which tells the true story of Paul Rusesa-Sabagina, a hotel manager who housed over 1,000 Tutsi refugees during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Potential investors in the film wanted a bigger box office star, like Wesley Snipes or Denzel Washington, for the role, but Cheadle's performance has been widely praised. Stephen Holden of the New York Times calls it a magnificent, understated portrayal of a watchful man who understands the workings of power. Let's listen to a clip from the film. In this scene, he's speaking to other Rwandans at the hotel after learning the UN peacekeeping troops will not intervene to save them.
There will be no rescue, no intervention force. We can only save ourselves. Many of you know influential people abroad. You must call these people.
Please, fax this to us.
You must tell them what will happen to us.
Yes.
Say goodbye. But when you say goodbye, say it as though you are reaching through the phone and holding their hand. Let them know that if they let go of that hand, you will die. We must shame them into sending help. Most importantly, this cannot be a refugee camp. The Interahamwe believe that the Mikulin is a 4-star Sabina hotel. That is the only thing that is keeping us alive.
Cheadle has had interesting roles in a series of hit movies. In the film Traffic, he played an agent of the Drug Enforcement Administration. In Boogie Nights, he played a porn actor who loved country music and called himself Buck. In Ocean's 11, he was a pipe bomb specialist. In the HBO movie The Rat Pack, he played Sammy Davis Jr. And in Devil in a Blue Dress, he played Mouse, an ex-con on a short fuse. Terry Gross spoke to John Cheadle last spring. He was starring in the movie The United States of Leland as a teacher in a juvenile hall.
Now, your father worked as a psychologist with children and teenagers. Were you able to draw on his experiences at all?
Not really, because he wouldn't talk about them. I mean, only in very vague general sense did he ever talk about his clients or his, you know, his work. He was very sort of devout about the whole client, you know, doctor privilege, and he never revealed anything that he specifically spoke with about any of his clients. It's more a manner that he has and more just a general way that he discussed problems and tries to get to the root of things that I think, you know, rubs off on me.
You went to the California Institute of the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it sounds like you had a great drama teacher in high school. Early in your career, you were you had a regular part on the television series Fame, based on the movie Fame. How did high school for the performing arts and the TV series compare to the drama class life that you were used to in high school?
Well, I wasn't a regular on that show. I did a two-part, you know, one early in the year and one much later in that same season.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I even got attached to Fame was one of my college suite mates, Jesse Borrego, who played Jesse on the show and still one of my great friends today, we all went to this open call where they, you know, they're looking out of 3,000 people, they cast two people, and it was Jesse Borrego and Nia Peoples. And Jesse was, in his inimical way, didn't leave any contact information. All he had was a snapshot. So they were literally putting his picture on the news saying, "Have you seen this person? If you have seen this person, please tell him to call in because, you know, he has a job." So people were coming up to us at school going, "I just saw your picture on the news." And we're like, "Yeah, right." You know, he didn't believe it. And then finally they tracked him down and took him down there. So that's kind of how I got involved with that, just from, you know, going to the set with him and hanging around and meeting the people that were on the set.
The role that really got you a lot of attention early in your career and won you an award from the Los Angeles Film Critics is your role in Devil in a Blue Dress, which is a film adaptation of a Walter Mosley Private Eye novel, you know, with the main character Easy Rollins, who in the movie was played by Denzel Washington, and you played Easy's old friend Mouse, who's an ex-con and is quite crazy and really kind of gets off on violence.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, let me play a scene from that movie. In this scene, Easy is on the floor with a guy holding a knife to his throat, and the guy's already started cutting. He's already bleeding. Mm-hmm. And then you walk in. This is a surprise. You walk in as Mouse, and you pull out a gun. The guy drops his knife. And then Easy wants to kind of question him and get to the bottom of the story. But no, you shoot him, and he runs away. So let's hear that scene.
Where's Daphne Monet, Frank? All right, look, all right, maybe you don't know where she is, but hey, we can help each other find her, man.
You heard, yeah.
Mouse, no!
College resident.
No.
Nah, he's busy right now. You're gonna have to call back.
Look, a rich man is willing to pay $1,000 just to talk to this girl. $1,000, that's a hell of a lot of money, man. Frank.
Wait. Let me try. Now, look here, Frank. It's Frank, right?
Yeah.
Frank?
What the hell are you? You ain't got on me! What the hell is wrong with you, man? Don't you ever grab me when I got a gun in my hand.
That's Denzel Washington and my guest Don Cheadle in a scene from Devil in a Blue Dress. How did you feel about taking this role, given how skeptical you were of all the kind of crime roles that were available to you at that time? Did this one seem qualitatively different?
Well, it was. I mean, it was a great writing piece and a great director, Carl Franklin, and Denzel, great actor to work with. It was a no-brainer. And he was such... He wasn't just a pat sort of cookie cutter character. That's the other thing about Mouse, is he wasn't these bad television, you know, portrayals of Gangster X. He was sort of a complex and interesting person to me, you know, which is always fun to play. And I don't mind playing a character like that as long as they have shades. You know, so often these roles that I was talking about that we were offered earlier, they were just the guy that was there to hold the gun and, you know, in this scene, scare this white woman, you know, or in this scene, you're being chased by you were more a function than you were a character. And Mouse was very much a character.
How did your portrayal of Mouse change your career and the kind of roles that you were offered?
No, there were some people who wanted me to come, you know, be a psychopath in their movie. And I kind of just rejected those roles because a lot of them were, again, underdeveloped and not as well realized with in the hands of people who weren't as talented as Carl. I just thought this is not going to be anywhere near the same sort of, we're not going to get anywhere near the same sort of product. And I don't need to start going down that road, you know, getting typecast as that. So I strayed away from that. Like right after Devil, I think I did Boogie Nights and I did Volcano and I did Rosewood and I remember I did 5 movies that next year, and they were all very different roles and they were all very different characters, which is really exciting, you know, to me. But I think it did sort of put my name out there in a way that hadn't happened before.
Boogie Nights is such a great film. This is Paul Thomas Anderson's film that's set in the pornography trade in, it's the 80s, isn't it? It's the 70s or the 80s? I can't
70s,
remember.
80s, it spans both.
Yeah. And you play this character named Buck, because you love country music, and sometimes kind of dress in country kind of clothes, and you're mm-hmm. one of the porn actors, but you also sell audio equipment. And I'm going to mm-hmm. play a scene where you're selling audio. You're in the store selling audio to a customer. Here you are.
This is hi-fi. Okay. High fidelity. You know what that means? That means this is the highest quality fidelity. Hi-fi. Those are 2 very important things to have in the stereo system.
What's the price for the 420?
I have this very unit in my home.
Really?
Yes, I do. But of course, I got it modified with the TK-421, which kicks it up another, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 quads per channel, you know. But that's technical talk. That doesn't really concern you. You're still a little uncertain, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know what you need? You need a test drive. That's what you need. You need a test drive. I mean, it's one thing to hear it from Buck's mouth. It's another thing to hear it from the TK-421. So let me just pop in this 8-track, and you just give a listen, tell me what you think, okay?
Woo! Huh. You hear that? You hear the bass, right? You hear it? It kicks. It turns. It curls up your belly. Makes you want to freaky deaky, right?
That's my guest Don Cheadle in a scene from Boogie Nights. That is such a great scene. I love the three or four quads per channel. Like, yeah, what the heck are quads per channel?
That was the most fun, sitting on the set with Paul and going, now what is the exact wrong thing? What's the most perfect, incorrect thing for you to say? And trying to come up, well, should it be, you know, quads per, what is it, channels per? So when we lit up on quads per channel, it was like, yeah, go do that. Go say that.
There's a great scene toward the end of Boogie Nights in which you're buying donuts. And, you know, you're choosing two of the chocolates and two of the old fashions. And suddenly this guy walks in with a big gun and it's an armed robbery. And another guy shoots him and everybody's dead except for you. Their blood is all over your clothes. But, you know, watching your face in that scene is really interesting because you're just like, oh, boy, the chocolate donuts. And then you're watching in shock and fear as all the stuff happens around you, and you're trying to kind of make yourself invisible, which you can't really do. Can you talk a little bit about shooting that scene?
That was a donut shop, I believe, on Magnolia Boulevard, or one of the big, you know, valley streets, east-west streets. And it was just Paul, another one of these Paul's visions where he just was, how can we put this guy in a situation where he can come up, but he had nothing to do with it? He's the hapless victim of something. But then, you know, because at the end of that scene, obviously he gets that money that was this guy was trying to rob, and he takes it. And it was that whole moral question of should he take the money, should he not? And he does that real long push in to Buck as he's standing there thinking about what to do, mm-hmm. you know, and he's in his sort of moral dilemma about is this right or wrong, and kind of forgets that he's got bodies all around and blood all over him, and goes, hey, I can get my store. And I just think it's great because it's really convoluted and very jangly. Things don't make sense, but it makes perfect sense, which is kind of what Paul does the best, you know.
Don Cheadle speaking with Terry Gross. He stars in the new film Hotel Rwanda. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actor Don Cheadle. His films include Traffic, Ocean's 11, The Rat Pack, Boogie Nights, and Devil in a Blue Dress. He stars in the new film, Hotel Rwanda.
You're, I think, about 5'7". Do I have that right?
5'8".
5'8".
And a half. Thank you very much.
Excuse me. I think you can use your size to different effects. I mean, you're very muscular. And in some roles, like in Boogie Nights, you could have a kind of physically vulnerable look. And then in roles like Traffic or Out of Sight, you can look really strong and able to use that strength. Can you talk about making your body work in both directions?
I think it's something that happens inside, too, that just kind of permeates. I think strong people, when you see someone and you go, that person's strong, very often it doesn't have anything to do with their physicality. You know, it has to do with something that's behind their eyes or something that's inside them that emanates, or some way that they move through a room or move through people. You just go, that guy is not to be messed with, or that guy is very forthright in his, you know, in his direction. There's just something that's very grounded about people like that. And for Buck, I really didn't think about doing anything physically for him. I just really sort of tried to feel kind of wrecked inside, you know, kind of like a house of cards inside that's very, can be toppled, you know, real easily, and always trying to find, he's trying to always find that, you know, because he was a cowboy, then he had sort of his Earth, Wind, and Fire look, and, you know, and then he trotted out the whole Curtis Mayfield thing, the Sly Stone. I mean, he had no idea what he wanted or who he was. The only thing he did know was that he wanted to have Buck Super Stereo World, you know, that was very important to him, and that he was an actor. You know, he was a legitimate person. And that kind of thing, I don't know how that comes off physically, but that's what I was trying to work with him on the inside. And, you know, something like a part like Out of Sight or a part like, you know, Traffic, you go, oh, I'm going to be in a short T-shirt and these guys probably do exercise, so I better, you know? It's just, that's just a basic, just go work out.
Don Cheadle is my guest. A few years ago, you were in the HBO Rat Pack movie playing the role of Sammy Davis Jr. Joe Mantegna was Dean Martin. Ray Liotta was Frank Sinatra. What did you think of Sammy Davis when you were young? Was he on your map at all? I mean,
he wasn't. He wasn't really on my map. The only time that he was on my map is when I would hear my parents and family talking about him, and not necessarily the most glowing of terms about what he represented at that time. You know, that was right around the time when I was growing up that he was, with Nixon, and, you know, there was that whole thing about him hugging Nixon, and that was a big flap, you know, in the community. And I just never really felt, from even seeing his performances, I thought, this dude is incredible. This dude is unbelievable performer. But as a person, he always seemed kind of slippery to me, you know? That's how I would always think of him, as this guy who's just too slick for school. But undoubtedly, incredibly talented.
Did your opinion of him change when you played him?
I wouldn't say that my opinion of him changed, because it was never really that strongly formed. But I did learn more about him, what made him tick, from his own words, from his own viewpoint, which is also very interesting, you know, to see what he wrote about himself in his two books, you know. Yes, I Can, and I forget the name of his other book. But anyway, both of those books were very interesting. In as much as what he left out, you know, as what he put in, because there were some moments that I thought would have given rise to a lot of discussion about, you know, moments that he had with the Panthers and things that went down with he and Frank, things that you thought, well, obviously you're going to talk about your anger at this situation, or how you, like when he spoke about his anger to Frank, it never had anything to do with any sort of racial anything. It was about Frank's sort of pejorative viewpoint of his lifestyle, which, you know, he completely turned around. They didn't talk for many years together, and then the wives got them together and they sort of patched it up. But he never spoke about things that I thought he has to have some sort of feeling about, you know, what went down with those guys and sort of the situations of being able to perform in places that you couldn't get in and your family had to come in the back door. And I mean, all of those things, I thought that those have to show up someplace emotionally in his book, and he never really dealt with them.
Did you do your own singing for the part?
In a couple of songs, yeah.
And did you try to get his voice?
Yeah, as close as I could, yeah. On the live, the stage when we were singing, the Hey There that we were doing live, mm-hmm, that was live.
Well, why don't we hear that song as performed in the Rat Pack movie, and this is Don Cheadle in the role of Sammy Davis.
Hey there.
Hey. Hey, you want to laugh? Go sit on the audience. The show to do it.
You used to be too wise. Hey there.
What the hell is it, Sam?
Sing us another tune, Sam.
You think someday she'll run to you.
Better forget.
Don Cheadle in Rat Pack, with Cheadle as Sammy Davis, and Joe Mantegna as Dean Martin, Ray Liotta as Frank Sinatra. Was it fun to be part of the Rat Pack, if only in the movies?
Oh, yeah. It was a lot of fun. I mean, whenever you have a fraternity like that, and everybody in the movie was cool to work with, you know. And in the movie, you know, Sammy twirls guns and obviously has to tap dance and sing and plays the drums and, you know, plays the trumpet. It was like, Jesus, I gotta, like, you know, get all of this stuff down to a reasonable facsimile of believability. So every day it was great, because every day it was like I was back in school, because I had, you know, a drum tutorial at 11, and I had a trumpet, you know, session at 1, and then from 3 to 6 I was working with Savion Glover to get the tap dancing numbers down, and the next day I would have to do the gun twirling, and then, you know, so every day it was sort of this intensive Sammy Davis Jr. school. That's when it's really fun being an actor, because you get to sort of touch on all these different aspects of yourself and of other people that you normally wouldn't, you know.
Don Cheadle is starring in the new film Hotel Rwanda. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex, by journalist Susan Shapiro. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, Shaking Hands with the Devil. We hear from General Romeo Dallaire, commander of the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda during the genocide. Also, critic-at-large John Powers reviews the new DVD reissue of Mikey and Nikki, the 1976 film written and directed by Elaine May and starring John Cassavetes and Peter Falk. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The film Hotel Rwanda and debate about ethnic massacres in the Darfur region of Sudan have stirred bitter memories of the world's failure to stop the Rwandan genocide in 1994. With that in mind, today we return to Terry's interview with Canadian General Romeo Dallaire, who took over the command of the UN Observer mission in Uganda and Rwanda a few months before the violence began. When Dallaire arrived, Rwanda was negotiating a peace agreement to end its civil war. But in April of 1994, the plane carrying the Hutu president of Rwanda was shot down. Hutu extremists accused ethnic Tutsis of the assassination and began a massacre that turned into a genocide. An estimated 800,000 Rwandan men, women, and children were murdered in 100 days. Unable to stop the slaughter, General Dallaire remained in Rwanda and tried to protect as many people as he could, In September, he returned home. 4 years later, he testified at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. After that, he said his mind and body decided to give up. Suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, he was given a medical discharge from the Army in 2000. He's now special advisor to the Canadian government on war-affected children. He describes his memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, as a story of betrayal, failure, naivete, indifference, inhumanity, and evil. His book is now out in paperback. Terry spoke with General Dallaire last year.
Now, the genocide started after the president of Rwanda was shot down in his plane on April 6th of 1994. At what point did you realize that the world in Rwanda was about to change?
Oh, well, the workups to the actual event had made the scenario very, very complex and very tense. So we were already in an atmosphere of either a resolution or a blowout. And we were sort of sitting, monitoring both sides and anticipating, hopefully, a positive one, but very much aware that a negative solution might be coming, and that is a humanitarian catastrophe, as we had been informed. And so when the president's plane went down, my first reaction is that the whole mission, the whole scenario is at risk. But it took till the next afternoon, within about 24 hours, when the rebel forces decided to start fighting, that the full realization that the mission formally was now ended and that we were in the middle of a civil war and what looked like something moving away from ethnic cleansing very much towards a genocide.
Do you remember hearing the broadcasts on the radio that urged Hutus to start killing Tutsis?
Well, those broadcasts were given in Kinyarwanda, so they rarely spoke in French or in English, which I speak. And so they were always, when we were able to get the people finally, translated for us. And yes, I still have transcripts of those very explicit instructions given by that extremist radio to people to where to go kill the Tutsis, how to kill them, making sure that they killed the children, because the rebels that are attacking now are the children of those that they had killed in the 50s but had omitted to kill those children.
At what point did you realize that what was happening in Rwanda went beyond civil war, that it was actually turning into genocide?
Well, by the fourth day in that ballpark, we had seen that the political decapitation had ebbed. In fact, literally, all moderate Tutsi or Hutu leaders of any sort were targeted, and they had been on lists, and the extremists knew exactly where they lived, had targeted them, and went in and killed the bulk of them with their families, with some of them escaping, and some of them we were able to get out. And then the killings continued. And by then, the term ethnic cleansing was very much in use. I had already sent from my previous command troops to Yugoslavia and so on, so that was what we thought was evolving. And it took, in fact, right up to around the 26th that I finally agreed with the ICRC, the International Red Cross representative, as we discussed this absolutely catastrophic continuum of slaughter, that we were in the middle of a genocide. And it took that long because, to me, genocide was equivalent to Holocaust. That's how we had been educated. And so I just couldn't imagine a Holocaust. And so it took time to finally grasp the fact that this was a genocide, and we had to influence the international community accordingly.
Much of the genocide in Rwanda was carried out with machetes. How did the fact that that's the way so many of the murders were being accomplished, how did that affect your mission in terms of what you needed to do to protect people, in terms of what the medical needs of the people around you were like? And
well, it's one of the most horrific ways of killing people. I mean, in regards to young children, it's very effective because their heads come off rapidly, or they can cut them in two. But with adults, you got to hack and slash a couple times. And these extremists, the militias and so on, at times were drugged up or boozed up and had been killing all day, so it's very fatiguing. And so what they resorted to is, instead of ensuring the people were dead, is that they'd injure them enough that they were immobile and that they would bleed to death. And so ultimately what happened is that you had people literally dying over days in the heat and or in the thrown still alive but suffering in latrines and situations like that, or thrown into the water injured and still alive, not able to save themselves. And those scenarios created incredible moral dilemmas in as much as there was in large parts of Rwanda up to 30% of HIV/AIDS before the war started, and soldiers don't run around with rubber gloves, and so the blood was all over the place. And to what extent do those soldiers expose themselves in helping people to contracting HIV/AIDS? And it was interesting that the bulk of the forces that I had responded that they would not put their lives of their soldiers at risk in trying to save these people in any way, shape, or form because of HIV/AIDS. But a few countries said that AIDS or no AIDS, if people are suffering, their guys would go in.
Could you have gotten a shipment of rubber gloves from the UN?
I couldn't even get ammunition.
You couldn't get food. What am I thinking? Yeah.
There was nothing coming in. We had been totally and completely abandoned.
Early in the genocide, there was a radio station that was exhorting its listeners to kill Tutsis. A little later into the genocide, one of the people on the radio, I believe, was exhorting its listeners to kill you. And I think they were identifying you as the white man with the mustache.
Yes.
What can you tell us about what was actually said in the broadcast?
Well, the broadcast indicated that I, through my work, was sympathetic to the rebels, and that, in fact, wherever I went, the rebels would be following within a week or two. And the reason that they used that is the fact that whenever I met with the extremist leaders, they were so terrible in defending their positions in the Civil War Act part of it, is that they would often be overrun by the RPF. And so the radio simply made it clear that people, if they saw me, should kill me because I was essentially working for the other side. And so when that came out, I had still some white officers, and some of them had mustaches, Europeans. And they all started to become targets, and people had to fight off mobs and the like. So I had to order their evacuation just for their own safety.
Because they were white and had mustaches.
Yes, and they looked a bit like me, and it was close enough for the mob.
Did you shave?
No.
Really? Why not? If they're looking for a mustache, why not take it off?
No, there was no way that I was going to camouflage myself. In fact, I never even changed a uniform to be in combat uniform. I remained in my dress that I always had even before the war. I wore a flak jacket, and then because of the threat, I was ordered to carry a pistol. And I would not always go in my 4x4. I would, at times, depending on where I was going, use an APC, though.
What's an APC?
An armored personnel carrier.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did anyone come close to fulfilling the command to kill you?
Yes.
What happened?
I'm not going to talk about it.
Canadian General Romeo Dallaire speaking with Terry Gross. Dallaire commanded the UN peacekeeping forces in Rwanda in 1994. His memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, is now out in paper. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian general who led the UN peacekeeping mission in Rwanda just before and during the 1994 genocide. His memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, describes his predicament during the massacres, commanding a few hundred soldiers who were allowed to use their weapons only in self-defense. They were surrounded by murdering mobs, cut off from the rest of the world.
What do you think the rest of the world could have done? You said the world abandoned you. You had no connection at all with the outside world. What do you think could have been done to help the troops and to help the people who were being massacred?
Well, before the actual war for about 3 months, the world or the bodies of decision knew the incredibly high risks of this peacekeeping mission failing, and that we would be faced with a catastrophic failure because we had had an informant that described exactly ultimately what happened. But there was absolutely no will in anybody to either send us troops nor to change the mandate to permit me to curtail the actions of the extremists in their training, distribution of arms, and the like. And so for those 3 months, no one was interested in giving me more capability to prevent the genocide of the Civil War to be launched. Once it was launched, then nations that have the capability of deploying troops rapidly to destroy right at the essence the destructive forces, the militias, so that it wouldn't propagate throughout the country, and in fact we would stop the killing very rapidly. Those countries that deliberately took decisions not to intervene. I mean, the Americans on the morning of the 7th of April were barely 12 hours into this situation in the Security Council in their working room, told everybody that not only were they not going to intervene, but they were going to help nobody who wanted to. And when I had up to four Franco-African countries already to send me troops, but they couldn't get there because there was no strategic lift, and once on the ground they had no equipment, it was a deliberate actions that Rwanda and Rwandans simply don't count. Because as that's going on, we're pouring tens of thousands of troops and billions of dollars into ex-Yugoslavia. And the question is how come one gang get all that support and the other gang gets nothing? And what we saw in the lack of depth of the media, they came in to take the pictures of the gore, but absolutely had no depth into why this was happening and why it was significant, in as much as they turned it into banal tribalism. And it was not tribalism. It was people, extremists, who didn't want to give up power, didn't want to share power, and aligned themselves in a way that they were going to eliminate the potential enemy, which happened to be in one particular tribal group. So as we banalize Rwanda, it's of no strategic value, geography, no strategic value, resources, it's only got tea and coffee. And as one officer told me, he said the only thing in Rwanda are humans, and there's already too many of them. It's overpopulated. And so as we banalize that and don't want to get involved in a very messy situation in Rwanda with blacks in Africa killing each other, Yugoslavia, that's different. This is more sophisticated. You know, these are great religions who have been in friction for so long, and their ethnicities have evolved. People have studied it. You've got the Ottoman Empire impact. Oh, yes, and they were allies in the Second World War, and we know some of them. And so they're very important. And the fact that they were in Europe makes them only more important, and ultimately probably because they were white made them that important. And that's why the Yugoslavia got everything.
Even though the former Yugoslavia got much more in the way of military support and other support from Western countries, the role of peacekeepers, of UN peacekeepers there, has been questioned by many people. I'm wondering, just from your experience in Rwanda, what do you think we need to be rethinking about the role of peacekeepers and the resources that we give them?
What the peacekeepers today require is a whole set of new skills based on far more an intellectual basis than the pure warrior ethic that is trying to be watered down. And so what we're looking for today is, in fact, people who can be warriors but also have the intellectual depth to be able to be conflict resolvers, and so be value-added and be in the alleyways and talking with the people and helping them resolve the problems. And so that's why we want the officers, particularly in middle powers, to have skills and knowledge, particularly in anthropology and sociology and philosophy, so they can grasp the complexities of this era. Because this era is not like before. The post-Cold War era of conflict is exceptionally complex. It is incredibly ambiguous. And generals who run around the countryside saying that they shouldn't go in unless they have clear mandates and extra strategies and they're fearful of mission creep are people who are living in the wrong era.
General Dallaire, your book, Shake Hands with the Devil, is about your experiences leading the peacekeeping troops, the UN peacekeeping troops in Rwanda just before and during the genocide. The title again is Shake Hands with the Devil. In your book you write, "In Rwanda, I shook hands with the devil, so I know there is a God. I know the devil exists, and therefore I know there is a God." Who is the devil? Do you think of the devil that you shook hands with as being one person or more of a group phenomenon?
Well, there was one person in particular, and in fact, there were his sort of sidekicks in the militia leaders. I had to negotiate with these guys, although I had an option also shooting them between the eyes, but I'm not sure that would have provided anything, for their structures were so strong as that they would have replaced them, and then the whole force would have been again vulnerable. But what I saw in those people, in their eyes, was not the eyes of human beings, it were the eyes of evil. And I call it the devil because then my religion sort of qualifies us at that. And they were the devil. They were the evil. They had blood on their shirts. I mean, they could negotiate with me with no passion whatsoever, simply saying, yeah, okay, we'll stop massacring here so that you can move, you know, people between the lines for about 2 hours, and then we'll start up again. And so human beings don't talk of that nature. It is another entity. Even their hands were cold, but it was like a death cold. Death cold is not a temperature, it's a state. And so I was absolutely talking, negotiating, and touching what I would qualify as the most evil, and it is the devil.
When you were meeting with the men who you came to think of as the devil...
Yes.
You said you could have shot them between the eyes, but it probably wouldn't have done any good. Was there ever a moment where you thought, maybe I should shoot them between the eyes? And was the moment when you thought maybe they'd shoot you between the eyes? Because certainly you were their enemy.
Well, in fact, it's interesting that on one occasion I actually took all the bullets out of my pistol and made sure I didn't have them available in one of my meetings with them because of some of the sights I'd been seeing that day and the night before. Them shooting me, on the contrary, the fact that I was meeting with them to negotiate the transfer of people between the lines gave them a great sense of importance. They were actually meeting the general of the UN. I mean, he wants to see us, militia leaders, and not just the extremist generals. To them, it was a high point.
You emptied out your gun because you were afraid you would shoot them if you didn't do that?
Well, certainly the emotional position was that strong.
You went back to Rwanda for the 10th anniversary of the genocide.
Yes.
How did the country look to you, and was it helpful to you personally to go back there and see how the country had changed?
Well, I'm not sure if it's helpful in the full sense, because it seemed to be I was a bit zombie-esque. But the country is in much better shape. The beauty of it is still there. The warmth of many of the Rwandans is there, but very few friends have survived. And so it was a bit lonely on that side. And whenever I was looking at these sites all rebuilt, what was coming like a teleprompter in front of my eyes were the scenes in fast forward of what they looked like during the genocide. So it was good to touch base, but I don't think the shoe has dropped yet on its full impact on me.
General Dallaire, thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate you reflecting with us on your experiences. Thank you. Yeah. And I wish you all the best.
Well, you're very kind, and your questions were excellent.
Canadian General Romeo Dallaire speaking last year with Terry Gross. Dallaire is now Special Advisor to the Canadian Government on War-Affected Children. His memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, is out in paperback. A documentary about Dallaire, also called Shake Hands with the Devil, will be shown at the Sundance Film Festival, which begins today in Salt Lake City. Coming up, Mikey and Nikki, a 1976 thriller starring Peter Falk and John Cassavetes, which has just come out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. Elaine May's Mikey and Nikki came out in 1976 and starred John Cassavetes and Peter Falk as small-time gangsters. It's now out on DVD, and our critic John Powers says it's time for this overlooked film to get the audience it deserves.
When someone says the name Elaine May, most of us instantly think of comedy. Her famous sketch work with Mike Nichols, her directorial efforts like The Heartbreak Kid, and her legendary script doctoring on pictures like Tootsie and The Birdcage. Yet the greatest thing she ever did was also the unlikeliest, Mikey and Nikki, a rich, gritty, deadly serious story about two small-time hoods. Reckoned a disaster when it came out in 1976, this tale of friendship and betrayal has been nearly impossible to see ever since. But now it's available on DVD, and you can discover what few people realized at the time. Mikey and Nikki is one of the best American movies of the last 40 years. The action takes place over one long night on the streets of Philadelphia. John Cassavetes plays the mercurial Nicky, a vain, violent, charming thug who knows a contract has been put out on him. Afraid of dying, he calls for help from his childhood friend and fellow gangster, Mikey. That's Peter Falk, a family man who's as careful as Nicky is impetuous. There's only one problem. While Mikey is helping to calm his friend down, he's also selling him out. The two travel around the darkened city, drinking at bars, breaking into a cemetery to see the grave of Nicky's mom, and dropping in on Nicky's mistress. Along the way, these overgrown boys, just look at their names, joke, argue, reminisce, brawl, and though they aren't self-conscious men, touch on life's deepest questions. Here in the cemetery, Nicky brings up the ultimate issue of mortality.
You don't believe there's anything after you die?
Me personally, no. I believe you die, and that's it.
That doesn't scare you. To think that one day you'll die, you'll be over. You won't be anything. You won't know anything. You'll be nothing.
Look, Nick, you want to visit your mother? Let's visit your mother, because the conversation is stupid.
It isn't stupid. It's interesting if you're going to die.
Well, I'm not going to die, so I think it's stupid.
Yeah, well, you are someday.
Look, Nick.
You're going to die someday.
I'm not going to stand here at 1 o'clock in the morning and discuss what's going to happen to me when I die. I mean, that Michigas I leave to the Catholics.
It's impossible to talk about Mikey and Nikki without mentioning its loony production history, neatly outlined on the DVD's extras. Elaine May shot over 1 million feet of film, more than any previous movie, more than Ben-Hur, Lawrence of Arabia, or The Godfather. And this for a 105-minute picture whose typical scene features two guys alone talking. Evidently clueless about film mechanics, May often told the cameraman to keep shooting minutes after the film had run out. Yet miraculously enough, her bizarre methods paid off. She managed to bring something new to that most popular of movie forms, the gangster picture. Ever since the Roaring Twenties, gangsters have exercised a special hold over our national imagination. Early movie mobsters like Scarface and Little Caesar were metaphors for the immigrant encounter with American success. Their meteoric rise led to an equally precipitous fall. Over the years, such ideas grew deeper and more complicated, with The Godfather painting a baleful portrait of a corrupted Nixon-era America, Goodfellas offering a roach's eye view of the gaudy wise guy subculture, and The Sopranos presenting a postmodern mob whose members have partly learned how to behave by watching those other movies. What does Elaine May add to this tradition? She makes the gangster movie intimate. Although propelled by impending murder, Mikey and Nikki is a brilliant character study of two wildly different friends, neither especially likable, who just happen to be gangsters. And we come to grasp their whole lives in a single night. Nikki is a bundle of electrified nerve endings whose operatic charisma has won him countless friends and women, all of whom, it's worth pointing out, he treats like a pig. Although it's Nikki's manic energy that keeps things going, the movie's actually about the betrayer Mikey, who in Falk's astonishing performance is buffeted by childhood memories, personal resentments, and of course, financial calculation. A more apparently civilized man than Nikki, Mikey knows that given the choice between his mobster boss and his crazy, unreliable friend, the smart man will always choose the boss. The late critic Robert Warshaw wrote that gangsters are America's version of the tragic hero. Little Caesar's Rico is taken down by his violent vainglory. Michael Corleone winds up killing his family in order to save it. And Mikey, well, he's tragic too, but in a quintessentially modern way. He's not larger than life like Scarface or The Godfather. He's a small fry. But it's May's great triumph that Mikey's decision to sell out Nikki finally takes on its own horrible grandeur. It feels as inexorable as Oedipus discovering the truth of his past, or Lear winding up on the heath.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and writes a column on the media for LA Weekly. He reviewed the DVD release of Mikey and Nikki. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Colbert, fake senior correspondent for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, on Rathergate, This Week in God, and his other satirical reports. Join us for the next Fresh Air.